Shall we turn in our Bibles again to the book of Colossians, Colossians chapter 3. We are dealing with this passage here, which is a practical application of the truth that God has called us to lead heavenly lives, a life that is above the dust of this world. There's only one kind of creeping thing that the people of Israel were allowed to eat, and that was the grasshopper or the locust or insect of that kind. And the Torah says because they have legs to leap above the earth. And that's what we're meant to be. We're meant to leap above earthly things, to rise above earthly things. So we look at Colossians chapter 3, and we read from verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, and forgiving one another, if anyone has a complaint against another, even as Messiah forgave you, so you also must do. Now there in these modest words is laid out for us our obligation before God. As the elect of God, holy and beloved, we are to put on tender mercies, kindness. And then he speaks about humility. Humility is the absence of pride. He speaks about meekness, that's the absence of passion. He speaks about long-suffering, that is extended patience. We look at this. Humility, that means we keep ourselves low in our own estimation. We don't get to think too highly of ourselves. Shaul said, "I, according to the grace of God given to me, I tell you not to think more highly of yourself than you ought to think." Humility. It was Samuel that said to King Saul, "When you were little in your eyes, the Lord exalted you to be king over Israel. But now you have become proud, you have lost your kingdom." How important it is. In the prophet Hosea also, God speaks about his people. At one time, they were humble and they walked softly before him. And that was to their honor, God says. In Hosea chapter 13 and verse 1, when Ephraim spoke, trembling, he exalted himself in Israel. But when he offended through Baal worship, he died. It's good for us. The Bible says, happy is the man that fears always. That means not given to craven fear, but who walks softly before God, who remembers that God is in heaven and he is on earth. That is humility. It's also the awareness that apart from Messiah, there are three things that we must remember. Apart from Messiah, we are nothing. Apart from Messiah, we have nothing of value. And apart from Messiah, we can do nothing that pleases God. We are nothing, we have nothing, we can do nothing apart from Messiah. But of course, to have him in our lives, we have all his fullness. As we read, of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace. Galatians tells us in chapter 6, if any man thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, that man deceives himself. We are nothing. We have nothing. Shaul, writing to the believers in Corinth, he says, what do you have that you did not receive? Everything you have that is of any value in the sight of God, you received. And therefore, why do you boast as though you did not receive it? So we have nothing apart from Messiah. We can do nothing without him. He said, without me, you can do nothing. And that will help us, the realization of these great, three great facts will help us to keep low. John Bunyan wrote a little ditty in his famous book, Pilgrim's Progress. He that is down needs fear no fall. He that is low, no pride. It may be that someone says, I'm Everest. I'm like Everest. Look at this guy. He's like a molehill beside me. That was the Pharisee, wasn't it? In the temple. I thank you, God, I am not as other men are. Well, how much nearer is Mount Everest to the sun than the molehill? The sun is 93 million miles away. Everest, Mountain Everest, is 5 miles high. Does it make much of a difference between Everest and a molehill? And so we can apply that picture to ourselves. And we can say, however great, or whatever greatness we think we have, we're still infinitely distant from the Son of Righteousness, from the Messiah. And we all have need of his grace in our lives. So that'll keep us humble. The mountain is hardly closer to the sun than the molehill. Meekness is the next thing. It's the opposite of self-assertion. It's the absence of passion. Moses was the meekest man on the face of the earth. That's what we read in Numbers chapter 12. That is to say, he was a man who was capable of strong feeling. He got very angry at times for God and once for himself. Well, after 40 years with 2 million grumblers in a hot desert, you can't blame Moses. It's the opposite of passion. He was a very meek person. When his own brother and his sister spoke against him, we read about it in Numbers 12, has the Lord only spoken by Moses? Has he not spoken by us? He didn't defend himself. He didn't say, listen here, you're being unreasonable. He didn't say a word. He left it to God to defend him. That's the absence of passion. A meek person is someone who can be capable of strong feeling, but who can cope with them, who can handle them, who keeps the bit and bridle on them. That's meekness. It's not weakness. And then long-suffering is extended patience, even when wronged. David was fleeing from his son Absalom. We read about it in 2 Samuel chapter 16. As he was fleeing from Jerusalem, a Benjaminite, Gera, the son of Shimei, cursed him, threw stones at him. Come out, come out, you man of blood. God has rewarded you for the blood of the family of Shaul. Well, David had not been guilty of shedding any of the blood of the family of Shaul. Later on, some of them were executed, yes. But at this point, when he was fleeing, he had done nothing of the sort. And this man was cursing him. We read about it in 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse 11 and 12. And we see David's response. And that response only came because he recognized that God was in control, that God was allowing it. That's what helps us to be long-suffering. God is in control. God has allowed this. It's going to turn out all right. 2 Samuel 16, verse 11. And David said to Abishai and all his servants, see how my son, who came from my own body, seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjamite? Let him alone and let him curse. for so the Lord has ordered him. It may be that the Lord will look on my affliction and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day. David just ignored the dust and the stones that were being thrown at him. He said, God will take care of it. This is the emphasis on attitudes. In verse 11, it's attitude mainly, isn't it? Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. Now, actions follow in verse 12. Bearing with one another. That is something that's ongoing. It's a participle. That is to say, it's something that's continuous. It's not just today, but it's tomorrow as well. Bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Messiah forgave you, so you also must do. The problem of forgiveness is one of the greatest problems that you and I face as believers. How do we forgive? When do we forgive? Why do we forgive? This is a deep problem. And we have a great struggle with it because we have within us this self-defense mechanism where we want to be vindicated. Yes, if we are truly wronged, we have the right to be vindicated. But here we read that there are cases where we are to forbear. Let's take it in order. First of all, not taking offense is really long-suffering in action. In verse 12, we were to put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. This is long-suffering in action. In the book of Proverbs, bearing with one another. That is, someone else is stepping on our toes. We don't bite their head off. We are patient. In Proverbs chapter 25 and verse 15, this book of wisdom tells us that we can win over the person that is wronging us. Verse 15, by long forbearance a ruler is persuaded, and a gentle tongue breaks a bone. Forbearing, bearing with one another, not taking offense too readily. Maybe you've come to this Kayla and someone has just sailed past you with a face, a poker face, and you think, what have I done to them? Why didn't they say hello? Maybe you said hello to them, they didn't say hello back to you. Well, it might be that their shoe is pinching their toes. Or they're worried about something. Or they heard the bad news on the radio this morning and they're struggling with it. And they're lost to their surroundings. Give them, put the best construction as you can on it. I remember a famous storyteller, Ethel Barrett, saying that when she's telling one of her stories, there's a man in the front row looking at her and he scowled through the whole story. And she had to fight to keep up her enthusiasm in telling this story to the rest of the audience. And at the end of it, this man came up with the same straight face and he said, I've never enjoyed something so much in all my life. Still with that poker face. Well, it was his natural expression. He didn't have anything against her. She said she learned a lesson that night. Forbearing, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. That's something else. That is not holding on to offense. This is meekness in action. And again, it is something that's ongoing. In verse 12, we are to put on meekness as well as long-suffering. Here is meekness in action. In the book of Proverbs again, in verse chapter 19, Proverbs chapter 19, and verse 11. Solomon the Wise tells us, the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, and his glory is to overlook a transgression. That's a sure character, a trial of character. What is the person like when they've been unjustly treated, unjustly provoked? Do they demand their pound of flesh? Or do they cut it short? They've got lots to say against the offender, but no, the minimum is all right. I'll just say the least possible. That is a sure sign of a character, of good character in the person. A disposition to forgive even before being asked. That's what it amounts to. But of course, in a sense, we may be ready to forgive, but they have to be willing to receive that forgiveness. That's why the writer says here, even as Messiah forgave you, so you also must do. Messiah forgave you long before you asked him to forgive you. And it might be in the same way you say in your heart, I have already forgiven you, even before you apologize. That is, anticipating the apology, but not waiting for it before we forgive. And letting God take care of the situation. Putting it in the hands of God. That's what it means. And there's to be, we're to forgive one another. Moses saw two of his countrymen fighting with each other when they were still in Egypt. And he said to them, why do you fight? You are brothers. That is a good question. And we too are to seek reconciliation, seek somehow to make peace. And if the other person is not ready to make peace, still not to bear, to harbor a grudge and to build up feelings of resentment and bitterness, because in doing so, we harm ourselves most of all. There may be a cause for complaint. It says here, if anyone has a complaint against another, this may well be the case. But again, we trust in God that he's got everything in his hands. He's in control. And it has to be against any offender. And in this case, in this verse, it's someone who says they are believers. That person is a believer. Or he or she says so. That makes it harder. If an unbeliever offends us, we say, oh, he is an unbeliever, or she is an unbeliever. But when it's my brother or my sister, no wonder someone said, family quarrels are the bitterest of all quarrels. It's harder. When it's a brother or a sister, they should have known better. And you're perfectly right, they should have known better. But there we are. We're all human. And sooner or later, I'll be stepping on your toes, you'll be stepping on mine perhaps, I don't know. We must have this attitude. It's going to happen somewhere along the line. We can't always be making a tally of offenses. Let's be like Messiah who said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they are doing. It's difficult. It's one of the most difficult things God has ever asked us to do. But he says, I did it first before I asked you. And with his help, we can do so, and we can pray the disciples' prayer, forgive us our trespasses, even as we forgive those who trespass against us. Now, I know there are cases where someone has behaved outrageously, abominably, so that you cannot trust them anymore. We're not asking you to trust them. That is between you and God, whether you feel you can trust them, but you can forgive them. with God's help. That's what we're told. Forgiveness was freely bestowed on those who accepted the offer. Now he says here, even as Messiah forgave you, he's talking to believers. What about those who offend us who are not believers? Well, the Bible says, do not avenge yourselves. God says, vengeance is mine. I will repay. If there are some ungodly people who have made your life miserable, don't avenge yourself. Put it in God's hands. It's a very complicated situation, a complicated issue, and one that merits a study in and of itself. But for the time being, we seek, with God's help, to exercise a disposition that is forgiving, forbearing and forgiving. When he forgave us freely, finally, and forever. And it was his initiative. Here he is talking to his people Israel in the book of Hosea, chapter 14. Hosea chapter 14, verse 1, he says to his people Israel, I am ready to forgive you, but I cannot bestow my forgiveness on you until you say, I'm sorry. Now this is what God says. Hosea chapter 14, verse 1, O Israel, return to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take words with you and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all iniquity. Receive us graciously, for we will offer the sacrifices of our lips. In verse 4, here is God's response. I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned away from him. God was ready to forgive the moment they came to him, confessed their sin against him. David says in Psalm 32, I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. David formed the resolve within his heart, I said, and then he goes on to say, you forgave the iniquity of my sin. Even before I had come to you, you saw me coming and you ran out to meet me and covered me with kisses like the father of the prodigal son. All is forgiven. It's a sublime disposition. To some it comes easier than others because there are some human temperaments that are more magnanimous. There are others that are more choleric. Four basic temperaments of human temperaments are mentioned by our psychologists. But all of us need to struggle with this and with God's help to overcome it. So also do ye in the same spirit. The Lord will put everything right. The Lord will compensate the one that is wrong. The Lord will straighten out the wrongdoer. So also do ye. What about the fact that what about the situation where the offender remains impenitent? I haven't done anything wrong. I had a right to do or to say what I did. In that case, we just say, Lord, help me to cancel the debt that they owe me. I give it to you. And God will straighten it all out. He will not pass it by. He will straighten every score, settle every debt. So we come to verse 14. But above all these things put on love, which is the bond of perfection. Now, over and above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. An analogy can be drawn from the garments of the high priest. He had his undergarments, he had his long shirt, then he had his breastplate, then he had the robe of the ephod. And the picture here is just as the high priest put on his garments for glory and beauty. And the crowning garment was that long robe with the bells and the pomegranates on the hem of the robe. So love is like that. It's like that robe of the ephod that was woven throughout one piece and that Aaron, the high priest, wore. We'd see a picture of that if you go back to Exodus chapter 28, verse 31 to 35. Exodus chapter 28, from verse 31 to 35. You shall make the robe of the ephod all of blue. There shall be an opening for his head in the middle of it. It shall have a woven binding all around its opening, like the opening in a coat of mail, so that it does not tear. And upon its hem you shall make pomegranates of blue, purple, and scarlet all around its hem, and bells of gold between them all around. A golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate upon the hem of the robe all around. And it shall be upon Aaron when he ministers, and its sound will be heard when he goes into the holy place before the Lord, and when he comes out, that he may not die. Those golden bells and pomegranates, the pomegranates were really made of cloth, out of thread. Gold and blue and scarlet and purple. Blue, purple and scarlet all around its hem. Pomegranates speak of fruitfulness in service. The bells between them speak about the sweet sound of God's truth. I take that because when Shaul was writing to Timothy, he said the false teachers are like jangling bells, vain jangling. Their teaching, their false teaching, is like vain jangling. So I take the opposite to be the true teaching. The teaching of the truth is like the tinkle of the golden bells. So Aaron was to be a fruitful servant of the Lord, but he was also to be a servant of the Lord that taught the truth to his people. And these were reminders as he came before the presence of God that he was teaching the truth. The priest's lips should keep knowledge, says God in the prophet Malachi, and they should seek the law at his mouth. The robe. We come back to verse 14 here in Colossians 3. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. Just as Aaron put on his robes, so we robe ourselves. What do we put on ourselves? Tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. Then on top of them all, that robe of love. Messiah had a robe like that. It was woven throughout. It was of one piece. And when the soldiers crucified him, they said, let's not tear it. It's too beautiful to tear. Let's cast lots for it. Messiah says, I am your brother. You are my brothers. You are my sons. You are my children. Dress yourselves like me. I came clothed with love for the salvation of the sinner, the sinful world. Also, clothe yourselves with love. It's difficult, but it can be done with God's help. Remember, we are nothing, we can do nothing, we have nothing apart from him, but the converse is true when he lives within his people. All these virtues listed above, they can be ours. It is practice that makes perfect. It's not a question of, yes, I'm going to be kind, I'm going to be humble, etc. No, the Lord comes and says, now you need to exercise these virtues. You need to develop them. It's going to be painful to your old human nature. but practice makes perfect. He speaks about charity, love here, and the word used is that word agape in Greek, which speaks about a disinterested love, a love that doesn't study the merit of the object or of the person, but a love that comes from God and is sustained by God, maintained by Him. And when we feel we cannot love anymore, we ask God for His love to be poured into our hearts to sustain us and to renew our strength. In 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 5 through 7, Peter, in his second letter, chapter 1, verse 5 to 7, begins with faith and ends with love. Now that is significant. 2 Peter chapter 1 from verse 5 through 7. The first link in the chain is faith. The last link is love. But also for this very reason, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue. To virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance, godliness, to godliness, brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness, love. There's the golden chain. Each one is linked to the other. Each link has to be as strong as the other. The Bible, lastly, here in verse 14, speaks about love as the bond of perfection. It means the ligament. A ligament ties various parts of our body together. Our body is united and kept together by joints and bands and ligaments. Let's take an analogy. When God told His people to build a tabernacle, a mishkan, He said, you make 10 curtains of linen, 5 to a set, 2 sets of 5. Otherwise it would become too cumbersome to carry. 2 sets of 5 curtains, 30 feet, 30 cubits long or 28 cubits long, which is about 40 feet and so many feet wide. So you have these 2 sets of 5. How were they united together to make one covering? They had 50 loops on the hem, on the inside hem, 50 loops. And those loops were joined together by golden clasps, 50 golden clasps that went through the loops on the hems of the 2 sets of curtains, linking them together. It was those golden clasps that united those curtains together and made it one covering over the Mishkan. That is what the Bible speaks about, the bond of love. It unites God's people. It makes them one. We can take an application from those golden clasps that connected those loops in the hems of those curtains. Or another analogy is Aaron again. What did he have to keep all his garments together? A beautiful girdle. A girdle for glory and beauty, like a sash around his middle. And we read that when Yohanan saw Yeshua in his risen glory, he said he had around his chest a golden girdle. You and I are meant then to be clothed with love, and then this golden girdle, the bond of perfection. It is then something that we are to think on, pray on, and then seek to practice. God willing, next week we'll go on to the following verses, which speak about the peace of God and the Word of God. But what starts it all is the love of God. The more you love God, the more I love God, the more we will find it possible to love one another. May the Lord bless His word. We'll just have a word of prayer and then discussion.